Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on the program, the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times. Pinell County again tries prosecuting a person who's suing the cops. This story was written by Clarissa Sosin and was posted on August 13th. The judge sighed. He had a lot of hard questions for the young prosecutor in front of him. He'd sized up the young woman who worked for the Pinell County Attorney's Office. He knew the score. The judge, Gilberto V. Figueroa, used to be the Pinell County attorney himself. He could tell the case before him was a dud, and senior prosecutors had left it to her to sort out the mess. "How did you get tossed into this bucket of worms?" the judge can be heard saying in an audio recording of the July 8th hearing in the Central Pinell Justice Court in Coolidge. "I've been around long enough to know when the older guys are ducking." The bucket of worms he referred to was a nearly two-year-old case involving William Simpson, a motorist who'd been pulled over by Pinell County Sheriff's deputies on August 5th, 2024. Those deputies tased Simpson during the encounter, but didn't issue him any charges or citations. Now Simpson was facing three criminal misdemeanor charges from the traffic stop: reckless driving, resisting arrest, and failure to comply with an officer. The charges, which originally included two felonies, aggravated assault and endangerment, were brought before a grand jury 2 weeks after Simpson filed a notice of claim that he intended to sue for the encounter. His attorney, Paul Gattone, argued to Figueroa that the charges lacked probable cause and were filed vindictively as retaliation for the notice of claim. The sheriff's office confiscated video footage recorded by Simpson's private dashboard camera. His legal team believed the sheriff's office, knowing the video showed there was no reason to indict, withheld it from prosecutors. The lawyer also said that the county attorney's office wouldn't release documents and evidence through discovery that would show that the charges were retaliatory. Because of this, the attorney wanted the charges dropped, a form of sanctions against the county attorney for violating disclosure rules. The judge agreed. "Frankly, it's not a hard case to discern what is going on," Figueroa said. "There's obviously some hiding the ball going on. I don't know what's in those dispatches, phone calls, emails. I don't know what testimony was presented to the grand jury. But this is, in my opinion, at least from what I've seen in the pictures alone, the two pictures here alone, this was a grand jury who not only was able to indict a tuna sandwich, but did so." He dropped the charges with prejudice. That rarely happens in Arizona criminal courts. The reasons he listed on the dismissal were a lack of disclosure, a violation of Simpson's rights to a speedy trial, and the lack of response to the pending requests. Prosecutors can never refile the charges. "I'd like to think that I would have made different decisions than what's happening here," said Figueroa, who served as county attorney in the 1990s. "I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed this process has taken so long, and I'm certainly disappointed it would appear to be a violation of Mr. Simpson's rights." Elevated charges against people who try to sue. Simpson's legal team and other attorneys with clients in Pinell County said they suspect Simpson's case may be part of a pattern. The sheriff's office seems to bring criminal charges against people who intend to sue the office. The charges make the plaintiff's lives miserable, derail their civil cases, and insulate the sheriff's office from accountability. Last month, Phoenix New Times reported that the Pinell County Attorney's Office filed two misdemeanors against Thomas Garrow. On January 9th, a Pinell County Sheriff's deputy so violently detained Garrow, a 79-year-old deaf Lyft driver, that his passenger called 911. The passenger was terrified of the deputy and thought he was going to kill them during what should have been a drama-free traffic stop. Garo was taken to the hospital after the encounter and released with two civil traffic citations, both of which were later dropped. New Times wrote about the incident and the driver's intent to file a notice of claim in April. The county attorney didn't file the charges, passive resisting arrest and failure to comply with a police officer, against Garo until May 25th, more than a month later. Billy Purd, an attorney who is helping with Simpson's case but is not licensed in Arizona and is not representing him, read about the charges against Garo and saw parallels with Simpson's situation. Simpson filed his notice of claim on January 29, 2025. He was indicted 2 weeks later. "There might be a custom," Purd said, using a term for an informal policy or practice within the sheriff's office. Simpson has since sued the deputy, Brando Ribscheid, in federal court. He waited for the criminal case to resolve, knowing those charges would complicate a civil suit. "For the judge to tell me good luck in my civil case and the lawsuit makes me feel that I have a chance against them," Simpson told Phoenix New Times. "But you know, it'll only take one other judge to say qualified immunity. That's all it takes, and this lawsuit is done." In the complaint, Simpson accuses Ribscheid of using excessive force when he tased him during the traffic stop. He also claims the deputy submitted the criminal charges against him maliciously as retaliation for his pending civil suit and violated his First Amendment rights in doing so. Pinal County Sheriff Ross Teeple and County Attorney Brad Miller are not named in the lawsuit. "I don't need to fight a cop on the street," Simpson said of his lawsuit and the resisting arrest charges that Figueroa dropped. "I'll go to jail. I'll go spend the night in jail and fight you later. I'll fight you in court. I'll fight with whoever I need to fight in court. I'm not going to fight you on the street. It's going to get me dead. The cop is going to win every time." When asked for comment, Sam Salzwedel, a spokesperson for the Pinal County Sheriff's Office, directed New Times to reach out to the county attorney's office. "When we receive notices of claim, we pass them along to the county attorney," he wrote. "That's pretty much it. We don't flag people in our system as having filed a notice of claim." Pinal County Attorney's Office spokesperson Christy Kelly said she was unable to get in touch with the attorneys assigned to the case in time for comment on this story. How deputies turned a routine stop into a fiasco. The pictures the judge referred to in the hearing were screenshots from Simpson's confiscated dash camera footage. They show Simpson, who Ribscheid pulled over for speeding, standing at the rear bumper of his pickup truck, where the deputy had ordered him to stand instead of approaching his window. Simpson's arms are in the air, and the deputies on the scene are nowhere near him. His legal team obtained the footage through a public records request and included the screenshots in their motion. They later received body camera footage from one of the deputies on the scene through the criminal disclosure process and included screenshots from that footage in the federal complaint they filed. Footage shows Simpson being pulled over on I-10 near Eloy. Ribscheid motions at him from his patrol vehicle to get out of the pickup and walk towards him, while Simpson walks to the back fender, yelling at the deputy with his arms clearly in the air. Another deputy pulls in and gets out of his vehicle. With his arms in the air, Simpson argues with the deputies briefly. Ribscheid, who has his taser out, tries to tase him, missing. A third deputy with a canine walks over from the front of Simpson's truck. When the taser misses, the deputy yells at Simpson to get on his knees, or he'll get bit. Simpson starts to kneel when Ribscheid fires the taser again, this time successfully, and Simpson falls to the ground. As soon as he went to give up, it finally worked and he fell. The deputy wearing the body cam can be heard saying about the tasing later in the footage. Simpson said he was angry that he was being pulled over because he felt the deputy had been driving erratically. He'd been driving behind Rebscheid, whose speed was fluctuating in the left passing lane, when he decided to pass in the middle lane. Rebscheid then pulled him over. Simpson yelled at the deputy, in part out of anger and in part to be heard over the noise of the traffic. He said he was confused about why he had to get out of his pickup rather than wait in it for the deputy to look at his license and papers. But he complied with all of the orders, and was complying when he was tased. Living with charges hanging over his head was stressful, Simpson said. In the year and a half that they were pending, he needed to find new work and a place to live. Knowing that landlords and bosses would run background checks and could reject him for pending felony charges made that process more difficult. But knowing that the dash cam video could exist gave him hope. Without it, he thinks he'd have been convicted and serving time. He originally installed them as a precaution. He knew that if he ever got into an accident or needed documentation of a traffic stop, the camera would provide it. But his cameras aren't always reliable, he said. Thank God it was working that day, Simpson said. It would definitely be my word against his. The video shows that there's nobody around me to assault. There's nobody around me to resist. County attorneys stonewall records requests. The federal lawsuit accuses Rebscheid of purposefully not handing over the video footage or telling the county attorney's office that it existed before the grand jury, because it undermines the case against Simpson. The assigned prosecuting attorney learned of the existence of this video footage from plaintiff's criminal defense attorney, the complaint reads. After their client was indicted in Pinell County Superior Court, Simpson's attorneys zeroed in on the two-week period between his filing the notice of claim and the grand jury convening. According to their motions for sanctions, they began making requests from the county attorney's office in April 2025 for documentation and evidence that they believe showed the charges were retaliatory and lacked probable cause. Given the peculiar timing, defendant is entitled to discover documents that may shed light on whether the criminal prosecution was triggered by or in any way motivated by defendants engaging in his First Amendment-protected activity of filing a civil legal claim, the motion for sanctions read. The discovery request included all texts and emails about Simpson sent during those 2 weeks among Rebscheid and the other deputies involved in the traffic stop, Sergeant Brian Messing and deputies Jay Montoya and Greg Sanders, as well as any communications sent by Rebscheid about receiving the notice of claim. It also included correspondence from that time period between Sidney Prudence, who is the county deputy attorney assigned to present the case to the grand jury, and Messing, the state's witness who testified. The attorneys also requested materials between the date of the incident and the date of grand jury, including correspondence between Messing and other sheriff's employees assigning Messing to investigate the case. They also asked for any documentation that Messing tried to get or watch the footage recorded on Simpson's confiscated dashboard camera, footage they believe proved there was no probable cause to indict their client. These items together painted a picture of what Simpson's legal team said is a deliberate pattern of obfuscation and stonewalling that led to bogus charges. In May 2025, the month after Simpson's attorney submitted the requests, the county attorney's office dropped the two felonies and one of the misdemeanors. It refiled the remaining two misdemeanors in the justice court. The attorneys sent the request to the new deputy county attorney assigned to the case, James Glover. By July 2025, they still hadn't heard back with a response, so they refiled their request again. More time passed with no response. In January of this year, 8 months after they first asked for the documents, they emailed Glover, letting him know that they would file what is called a Rule 15.7 motion. The motion asks the court to compel the county attorney's office to hand over the requests and sanction it for denying their client his right to disclosure by not responding. They still did not receive a response. The Pinal County Attorney's Office never responded about their requests in the criminal case. Simpson's team has since submitted multiple public records requests for the documents and has received just one response. The county attorney's office said that no correspondence existed between the attorney assigned to present the case to the grand jury and the sergeant who testified, Pird said. By the time Gattoni presented their case in Figueroa's courtroom last month, nearly 15 months had passed since they first filed their requests. "We didn't ask for anything onerous or unreasonable," Gattoni told the judge in the hearing. Figueroa chastised the county attorney's office for not even responding to the requests. If the issue was that the sheriff's office wasn't complying, he said, the county attorney's office needed to hold them accountable. "I don't know if the pressure was on to protect the sheriff's office on this. I can guess, but I don't know," Figueroa said. "I'm disappointed by the fact that there was no effort, at least not in my books, not in the materials I got, by the county attorney's office to exercise their strong discretion and the strong power that the county attorney's office has to make the sheriff's office comply." Figueroa peppered the newly assigned young county attorney with questions about the case, mainly what was presented to the grand jury. The photos of the encounter in front of him didn't add up to the charges that Simpson was indicted for, he said. And the fact that it included misdemeanors when grand juries typically only indict on felonies stunned him. "Somebody went in there with a 12-pack instead of a 6-pack and got the 2 felonies and 3 misdemeanors," the judge said. "I don't understand how that happened." The county attorney didn't have any answers. Next, a story written by Clarissa Sosin and posted on August 11th. Judge: aiding homeless people in Phoenix parks isn't protected speech. Two nonprofits fighting Phoenix's ordinance that restricts aid to homeless people in city parks faced a setback Tuesday after a federal judge ruled against them and canceled a scheduled hearing. Valle del Sol and Circle the City sued the city of Phoenix in Arizona District Court, arguing that by cracking down on feeding or providing medical aid to homeless people in city parks, the ordinance violates the First Amendment. District Judge Diane J. Humatua disagreed. She ruled against their motions for a preliminary injunction. On less than a day's notice, she also canceled a hearing where the two sides would present their cases. The court disagrees that plaintiffs' provision of medical care or food to the unhoused is inherently expressive conduct under the First Amendment, Humatua wrote in her ruling. The decision is not a nail in the coffin for the plaintiffs, but it is a setback that slows their case. They have 30 days to appeal the decision in the Ninth Circuit, or they can let the case progress in Humatua's court. Either process will take months longer than the immediate relief they sought. Plaintiff's attorney Will Knight, senior litigation counsel for the National Homelessness Law Center, said in a written statement that they were disappointed in the ruling and plan to look into all other legal options for relief. "We are disheartened that the trial court reached the incorrect conclusion," he wrote. "The city of Phoenix continues to prevent our most vulnerable unhoused neighbors from accessing basic human dignities of food and life-saving medical care. Our clients, Circle the City and Valle del Sol, are firmly committed to expressing their deeply held belief that all human beings deserve equal dignity, basic health care, and not to go hungry, regardless of their income bracket or housing status." Citing the ongoing litigation, the city declined to comment for this story. The case is one of two challenging the ordinance with a First Amendment argument. The plaintiffs in the second case, Orthodox Christian Ministry St. Herman's Table, and its minister and founder, Lance Brace, argued that their weekly food service in Cave Creek Park was an expression of their religious beliefs. A federal judge ruled in their favor a few days after the ordinance went into effect, granting a preliminary injunction that prohibits the city from enforcing the ordinance on them while their case works its way through court. St. Herman's Table is currently the only group that can legally distribute food in a park without a permit. The Phoenix City Council passed the ordinance in May to take effect in early June. The new rule makes it a misdemeanor to provide medical treatment and food in city parks without a permit, and it bans medical care with needles and needle exchanges altogether. Groups and individuals hoping to serve food or provide medical care must apply for a permit, but permits are limited. The city grants only 2 per approved park per month. Opponents called the ordinance punitive and said it would do more harm than good. Circle the City and Valle del Sol are medical nonprofits that work in city parks. Valle del Sol hosts needle exchanges, while Circle the City's medical teams provide care to people who want it. The two groups contend that providing food and medical care to homeless people is an expression of free speech. They asked Humatoa to either rule on the case or to allow them to continue their work without repercussions from the law while the case worked its way through the court. The nonprofits and the city were scheduled to present their sides to Humatoa in the now-canceled hearing in the Sandra Day O'Connor U.S. Courthouse on Wednesday morning. In her decision denying the injunction and canceling the hearing, Humatoa wrote that unlike pure speech, not all expressive actions are protected by the First Amendment. Even if the conduct is protected, the government has greater latitude in restricting expressive conduct than it does in reining in pure speech, she wrote. She wrote that food distribution and medical care are not purely expressive, the way dancing or music or written messages are. She also agreed with the city's argument that the nonprofit's work does not contain an expressive component, because their message is not obvious to passersby. The nonprofits don't distribute literature, put up signs, or otherwise display their message or viewpoint while doing their work. The court does not doubt plaintiffs intend to convey a particularized message that all people deserve dignity and aim to protest the government's lack of assistance in providing the homeless with resources, the judge wrote. But the court must also ask whether there is a great likelihood that the conduct in question would be understood by those who view it as the message that plaintiffs intend to convey. Lawsuit. Veteran with BB gun killed by Apache Junction police was deaf. This next story, written by Clarissa Sosin, was posted on August 14th. Apache Junction police officers killed a deaf man. The officers shot and killed Charles Back outside his home in Apache Junction around 7:30 p.m. on Valentine's Day. Back allegedly raised what turned out to be a BB gun at the officers and didn't comply with their commands to drop it. Now his son, Adam Back, has revealed in a wrongful death lawsuit filed this week that his father didn't drop the gun because the 69-year-old military veteran couldn't hear the officers. Because of his profound deafness, Charles could not hear the officers' commands. The lawsuit's complaint reads, Adam Back is taking the city of Apache Junction and 3 anonymous officers, Doe defendants in the suit, to federal court. He's suing for wrongful death, excessive force, and other claims related to the shooting. He also accuses the officers of violating the Americans with Disabilities Act by not providing any visual cues that they were officers. In the moments leading up to his death, Charles was subjected to terror, disorientation, and fear for his life, the complaint reads. He was blinded by bright lights in otherwise darkness, unable to hear anything, and unable to identify who was at his gate. He also alleges that members of the department showed up at the house at 4 a.m. about a month later and shined flashlights into the home. The officers said they were responding to a 911 call, but would not say what it was about. As of the filing of the complaint, Adam Back has not received a response to his request for the 911 calls or reports from that night. Plaintiffs, therefore, do not know whether the March visit was related to the February shooting, but include these allegations because the timing, circumstances, and lack of explanation have contributed and continue to contribute to Adam Back's distress, the complaint reads. Phoenix New Times could not reach Adam Back for this story. His attorney, Sailor Soinski, the city of Apache Junction, and its police departments did not respond to requests for comment. In February, the officers were responding to a report of a domestic violence call at Back's address. "He can hear a 101 yelling inside," the dispatcher told the officers, using code for a female subject. When the officers arrived, they came across a fenced-in yard with a locked gate. While the officers were on the radio with dispatch, trying to figure out how to get inside the gate or call the residents, Back came outside carrying what the officers thought was a handgun at his side. The officers shined their flashlights on him and yelled at him to drop it, saying that they were police. Within 30 seconds of arriving at his address, they fired 13 shots, 10 which struck Back's body directly. Doe defendants did not wait for dispatch to respond with Charles's information, attempt to use any means of less lethal force, or take the clear path of retreat available to them, the complaint reads. The East Valley Critical Incident Response Team, a regional task force made up of 8 police departments to investigate critical incidents, is investigating the shooting. The Mesa Police Department is spearheading the investigation. The Pinal County Attorney's Office will review it. Phoenix New Times reached out to the Pinal County Attorney's Office for an update on its status, but did not hear back in time for this story. In the lawsuit, Adam Back says that his family has suffered from his father's death emotionally and financially. Between the shooting and late-night visit by the officers a month later, their home is no longer the safe place it used to be, and the family no longer trusts law enforcement. Adam has lost peace and security in his home, and now feels continuous hypervigilance and anxiety, the lawsuit reads. According to the lawsuit, the family has had to pay for funeral expenses and repairs to the house and cars from the bullets. Charles Back was closely involved in their day-to-day life, driving their kids to school and helping his wife around the house when she was going through cancer treatments. Adam Back, who used to see his father once a week, had to take time off work to grieve. Adam Back has suffered the profound, permanent, and irreplaceable loss of his father, the lawsuit reads. He has lost his father's love, affection, companionship, and guidance. Here's a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on August 13th. Who is John Giles? Meet Hobbs, ex-Republican pick for lieutenant governor. After much speculation, Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs announced Tuesday that former Mesa Mayor John Giles, a Republican turned independent, would join her ticket as her running mate. While Hobbs' announcement came as no surprise, Giles' party affiliation history raised eyebrows. Last week, the New York Times reported, citing anonymous sources, the prominent anti-Trump Republican would be Hobbs' pick as the Democratic nominee for Arizona's first lieutenant governor. In November, Arizona voters will be casting a ballot for lieutenant governor after they approved creating the office via a 2022 ballot measure. If elected alongside Dobbs, Giles would be first in succession for governor. Whether you're a Democrat, independent, or Republican, Hobbs said, standing beside her running mate in a video announcement Tuesday, if you believe in protecting our freedoms and putting Arizona first, we're ready to fight for you. Giles, an Arizona native, has been a registered Republican since 1986, according to his Maricopa County voter file. From 2014 to 2025, he served as Mesa's mayor, a nonpartisan position. But his political preferences have seemingly shifted in the Trump era. Technically, he isn't a Republican anymore. In May, Axios Phoenix reported Giles changed his voter registration from Republican to no party preference or independent. His county voter file shows he also voted in the July 2026 Democratic primary. Extremists shouldn't stand in the way of getting things done, Giles said in the announcement campaign video. As mayor, I focused on getting results and bringing people together to solve problems. Over the past 4 years, Giles has moved away from the Republican Party, or at least the MAGA wing of it. He served as the co-chair of the Republicans for Harris Coalition in Arizona, and even spoke at the 2024 Democratic National Convention while he was still mayor. 2 years earlier, he endorsed Hobbs over MAGA firebrand Kerry Lake in the 2022 gubernatorial race. In the Senate race, he endorsed Mark Kelly, the Democrat, over Blake Masters, the Republican venture capitalist and protege of Peter Thiel. The GOP precinct in his legislative district censured Giles in response. With this pick, Hobbs' campaign appears to be wooing Arizona's independents. More than 302,000 voters register as other when selecting a political party, Arizona's Secretary of State's office data show. To win statewide races, Democrats and Republicans need to capture voters in this demographic. Comparatively, more than 193,000 voters registered as Republicans, while nearly 176,000 voters registered as Democrats. In November, Hobbs and Giles will face off against Trump-endorsed Representative Andy Biggs and his running mate, Sina Kerr, a former state senator and dairy farmer. It's unclear how much the candidate's lieutenant governor pick will matter to voters. Here's what you need to know about Hobbs' pick for her lieutenant governor. Who is John Giles? The Mason native served as the city's mayor for more than a decade. He ran for the position after the city's previous mayor, Scott Smith, resigned to run for governor. Giles also had a short stint on the city council in the late 90s. Giles won more than 72% of the vote in a 2014 special election, handily defeating Danny Ray, a small business owner. Giles went on to serve two more terms as Mesa's mayor, winning re-election with ease. Under his leadership, Mesa expanded its higher education footprint, supported small business development, and enshrined protections for LGBTQ+ residents. But Giles' vision for Mesa wasn't without pushback. Giles supported Arizona State University's expansion into downtown Mesa and then the Polytechnic campus. Not all Mesa residents were on board. Voters initially rejected a sales tax hike to fund the campus. Still, Giles pushed to spur interest in higher education in Mesa. Under his leadership, the city launched its Mesa College Promise program, which offered free community college tuition to eligible high school graduates. As the mayor of Arizona's third largest city, Giles pushed new solutions for citywide problems. He worked to launch Mesa's Off the Streets program, which aimed to convert local hotels into emergency housing shelters. Under his leadership, the city also implemented a climate action plan to make the city more sustainable. That plan included a goal to become carbon neutral by 2050. During Giles' second term, he spearheaded the revival of a non-discrimination ordinance to protect Mesa's LGBTQ+ community. City leaders discussed the ordinance in 2015, but conservatives in Mesa sank it. Part of that opposition came from members of Mesa's Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints community, which does not support same-sex marriage. Giles is also LDS. He served a 2-year mission for the church in South Korea and also went on to attend Brigham Young University in Utah. At BYU, he met his wife of more than 40 years, Dawn. Despite the pushback, Giles believed that protecting human rights and codifying LGBTQ+ protections in local statute was the right thing to do. Critics also targeted Giles for his vote in favor of a contract with CoreCivic, a private prison company. In the past 2 years, the company has gained national scrutiny for running deadly immigration and customs enforcement detention facilities, including two in Arizona. The idea was the city would hand people convicted of misdemeanors to CoreCivic to transport and house in its notorious Florence facility. Giles believed it was a cost-saving measure. As mayor, Giles also led Mesa's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. The city used federal relief funds to provide financial assistance to struggling small businesses. Later, they made the project, called the Mesa Business Builder, permanent. Since leaving office a year and a half ago, he has remained a public figure in the political sphere while also working as a government affairs lawyer for the firm Udall Shumway. The program continues now with this story written by Clarissa Sosin and posted on August 12th. Family sues after child gets E. coli at Arizona State Fair petting zoo. When you go to the Arizona State Fair with your kid, you expect to stuff them with cotton candy, spin them through the tilt-a-whirl, and put them to bed feeling a little woozy at worst. That wasn't the case for Elizabeth Felix. She left the Arizona State Fair last year with a 6-year-old son who'd contracted an E. coli infection from the fair's petting zoo. Felix sued the fair last week on behalf of her son, Julian Lopez. Lopez got so sick that he was hospitalized for weeks, according to the complaint. He suffered from hemolytic uremic syndrome, a complication from E. coli infections that can cause kidney failure, and had to undergo dialysis. He's expected to have chronic medical complications from the infection. She accused the fair of negligence for not taking proper precautions or training its staff to prevent the spread of E. coli from the petting zoo. These little kids, they pet the goats and they roll around in hay and stuff. They get poop on their hands and they eat candy or popcorn or whatever, Ron Simon, Felix's attorney, told Phoenix New Times. It's horrible, but it's also preventable. Felix is asking the fair to cover Lopez's medical bills and to pay for damages and future medical care costs. So far, the family has racked up $453,035 in medical bills, according to the complaint, and estimates that those costs could total $3 million over his lifetime. They want to make sure that they're fully and fairly compensated for the medical bills and lost wages and pain and suffering that their child has and will go through, Simon said. The Arizona State Fair did not respond to requests for comment. Lopez was one of dozens of children hospitalized with E. coli from the petting zoo at last year's fair. Several of them suffered the same kidney complications. Simon said the lawsuit, which was filed in Maricopa Superior Court on August 3rd, is the first one filed against the fair for the outbreak. Doctors first noticed young patients with E. coli symptoms in late October, according to reporting at the time. The common thread was that they'd all been to the petting zoo at the fair, which ran from September 19th to August 26th. The Arizona Department of Health investigated the outbreak but did not release information about its source, reporting by AZ Central found. Instead, parents went public with the help of Parker's Promise, a Tennessee-based nonprofit that focuses on environmental pathogenic illness. Phoenix and Lopez spent a lot of time in the petting sections of the fair, especially with the goats and potbelly pigs, before getting food and looking at other exhibits when they attended on October 26th, according to the complaint. While there were no readily available wash stations, there was hand sanitizer, which they availed themselves of, the complaint read. By October 29th, Lopez showed symptoms of E. coli poisoning, which includes bloody diarrhea, fever, and abdominal pain. He was hospitalized at Phoenix Children's Hospital on November 1st and tested for E. coli. By November 3rd, he was diagnosed with the most severe version of hemolytic uremic syndrome, which can cause kidney failure, especially in young children. He underwent multiple dialysis treatments and was hospitalized for 21 days. Julian will need to be monitored for many years and has a high probability of kidney failure and the need for a kidney transplant as he matures, the complaint reads. Why fed-up doctors at Banner Health are trying to form a union. This next story, written by Morgan Fisher, was posted on August 12th. Dr. Sayara Leah swung open the door of her office at Banner's Gilbert Health Center. Inside, she found the clinic's physician executive and human relations director waiting for her. "Have a seat," one of the managers said. They'd received Leah's 90-day notice. Leadership was ending her clinical duties that Friday morning, a full 86 days before her set final day. Leah had worked as a family care physician in the company's Gilbert location for 12 years. And just like that, Banner Health's managers forced her to turn over her laptop and badge and had her escorted out of the building. Leadership barred her from finishing patient workups and following up on diagnoses. Someone would collect the rest of her things. She could pick them up another day. "I didn't say goodbye to my patients," Leah said, through tears in an interview with Phoenix New Times. Essentially, they said, "Okay, should she continue to see patients, or should we send her home for fear that she'll spread the union?" And they chose to send me home. A week prior, Leah filed an unfair labor practice complaint with the National Labor Relations Board against her employer, alleging that Banner Health retaliated against her for bringing up a scheduling conflict in a group chat, a seemingly trivial matter that managers escalated. To represent her in the complaint, she enlisted an attorney with the Union for American Physicians and Dentists. She suspected Banner might see the complaint and fire her. So as she started her job hunt, she gave Banner her 90-day notice, a standard in the industry. Sure enough, management axed her, but not outright. A company cannot legally fire an employee for filing an unfair labor practice charge, and retaliating against a worker is illegal. Instead, the company barred her from the building while maintaining her pay and insurance until her 90 days were up in early August. Leah suspects that her affiliation with UAPD set Banner Health off. Before she filed her labor complaint, Leah said, the company didn't know something big was happening behind the scenes. Fed up with management, Banner Health's doctors were organizing a potential union. It's all profit-driven. If they succeed, Banner's physicians will have formed Arizona's only physicians union, and at the state's largest private employer, no less. Working with UAPD, physicians and dentists nationwide have formed more than 30 bargaining units across more than 100 healthcare settings. UAPD represents more than 7,000 physicians across the country. Six UAPD bargaining units in California have formed through the state's university system, among county and nonprofit employees, and an anesthesiologist corporation. Two UAPD bargaining units are in New Mexico, La Familia Health and Rehoboth McKinley Christian Healthcare Services. No other physicians are organized in a Banner Health setting. In 2024, the Phoenix-based Banner Health brought in revenue of $10.8 billion with $9.31 billion in expenses across operations in six states. It counts more than 30 physician clinics across the valley, including in Gilbert, Mesa, Chandler, Queen Creek, Maricopa, Sun City, Buckeye, and Peoria. Nearly 270 Banner physicians and other practitioners are eligible to join and vote in the formation of the union. Nurse practitioners, physician assistants, family medicine physicians, internal medicine physicians, and pediatricians. The doctors say they're organizing for better pay and to address a host of issues with their hospitals. They say administrators have placed profit above patient care and inundated doctors with administrative duties that force them to work long hours away from their patients. The doctors feel micromanaged, exhausted, and disrespected. They say the final straw came last year when Banner Health introduced a new policy. Administrators could dock physicians' base pay by as much as $15,000 a year if the company didn't meet certain revenue goals. Previously, Only patient care metrics could get a doctor's pay cut. When they announced these metrics, we were like, so we don't care how healthy our patients are anymore? This is just profit? Leah said. It's all profit-driven, which is very bizarre to us. In February 2025, after that policy was announced, Dr. Justin Watkins, another family medicine doctor at Gilbert Health Clinic, reached out to the Union of American Physicians and Dentists to discuss legal options. He and Leah say that they want to turn the company's priorities back toward patient care. I'm also, of course, fighting for a pay raise, Watkins said in a video he posted to Instagram. We have not had a significant pay raise in many years now. There needs to be more transparency in how Banner calculates our pay, our bonuses, and how we're able to earn our livings here with Banner. Leah, Watkins, and other physicians ramped up their organizing efforts and called an election after more than 30% of Banner Health physicians signed union authorization cards. In late July, NLRB officials mailed ballots to the Valley's Banner Health physicians in the Phoenix metro area. Those doctors have until August 26th to vote and mail back their ballots, which officials will count on September 2nd. If the majority of Banner Health's nearly 270 physicians vote in favor of unionizing, it will give them the power to collectively bargain with one of the country's largest nonprofit health systems. Physicians can work toward a contract to receive more protections and pay, be part of clinic-level issues, and get support in completing chronic administrative tasks. Arizona is a right-to-work state, meaning that employees cannot be forced to join a union or pay dues as a condition of keeping their job. Non-dues-paying members still benefit from the improved conditions, benefits, and pay that a bargaining union secures. These clinicians are the people that are going to be sitting at the table with their employer, Gomez said. They're the people that started this, the people that are leading this. Banner Health did not respond to New Times' request to comment, but they've pushed back against the unionizing effort online. The company created a site on their website that asks physicians to vote no so Banner can remain strong as one team. The site also criticizes the effort by writing that unions cannot guarantee anything, and contract negotiations take time with no guaranteed outcome. Unfair labor practice suit. The beginning of the end for Leah began in October of 2025. Another physician at her health center noticed that staff incorrectly scheduled hundreds of patients on Saturdays for all of 2026. Just looked at my schedule in 2026, Leah said in the clinic's physician group chat. Every Saturday starting January 3rd is open, and my schedules are full. Someone should probably look at all the provider schedules because I suspect we all are working every Saturday starting January 3rd and have patients scheduled. After another physician responded that their schedule had the same issue, Leah sent a follow-up message. Could we make sure that patients get rescheduled timely? She asked. Whenever patients need to be rescheduled due to scheduling errors, I hear a lot of complaints that they were not notified until the week of, and then there are no appointments for 3 months. A few days later, Leah received a message from her manager's boss requesting a meeting. There, leaders told her they saw her message as implying that your manager is incompetent and it was inappropriate. In Leah's manager evaluation, which she shared with New Times, Banner Health leadership characterized Leah's message as uncomfortable and said it misaligned with Banner's values. Managers told her she needed to bring concerns directly to her manager or director, or else risk corrective action, which could lead to her firing. Leah believes her director escalated the incident because Leah has often spoken up about issues related to patient care. It definitely shook me up, rattled me, she said. I felt like I was being targeted, probably because I speak up. After graduating from medical school, Leah started her residency at Banner Health's Medical Center in downtown Phoenix. Later, she joined her longtime practice in Gilbert. Banner is all I've known for my whole career, Leah said. It was very difficult for me because I was ready to retire with Banner. I was very committed to the patients that I was taking care of and my colleagues. On August 3rd, she started a new job at a company called CenterWell, which is a Medicare company contracted with Humana, providing senior primary care or geriatrics. Still, because Banner kept her on payroll through August, she'll be able to vote in the union election. I got messages from surgeons, from neurologists, from specialists all over the valley, and had heard about it, and they were asking, "Are you okay? Oh my gosh, how did this happen?" she said. People were pretty shocked to hear that this could happen to someone who was working for Banner for 15 years and never caused any kind of problem or had any issues. Leah wasn't able to have the in-person sentimental send-off she wanted after 15 years with the company. On August 5th, UAPD posted a video of Leah speaking about her suit and support for the union. Support from dozens of patients rolled into the comments. "Absolutely the best doctor I've had, so caring and understanding," a user named Christina wrote. "Thank you, Dr. Leah, for being an amazing doctor and speaking out." Another user named Christy thanked Leah for being very good to my mom in her journey with dementia, she wrote. "You are the best physician I have ever encountered. Please let us know where you will be next." Instagram user Mary wrote that she's devastated you are gone. "You were the best," Mary wrote. "I hope you practice somewhere else someday. I will be there." Here's a story written by Clarissa Sosin and posted on August 10th. Security, EMT, homeless advocates, scrap on blazing Phoenix sidewalk. The advocate spoke gently to the slumped over woman propped up against her on the curb. "Anna, they are going to put you in the ice bag," Sophia Alicia said. "You have to wake up. Hey, baby, they're going to put you in the ice bag, okay?" It was just after 10:30 in the morning on August 1st, and Phoenix was in the middle of a heat wave. Temperatures were already well over 100 degrees, on the way to 116. Anna, who was homeless and lived in the encampment near downtown Phoenix, known as the Zone, was suffering from possible heat stroke and possibly an overdose. Alicia held her up while firefighters placed bags of ice on her body to cool her down so they could take her to the hospital. Nearby stood a woman dressed in all black with EMT in large white letters emblazoned on the back of her shirt. She and three security guards had responded to the scene from the nearby Key campus, a homeless solutions hub in the heart of the Zone. Slung over her shoulder was a red backpack with a white cross on the front, a medical kit that the EMT had just finished packing up. "Do you see what happened here?" Alicia said to her, suddenly irate. "You didn't call 911 regardless of your training. If these ice bags hadn't been on her, her temperature would have been even more elevated." "You done?" one of the security guards said, trying to cut her off. "No, I'm not fucking done," Alicia yelled. "They are about to put her in an ice bag." "You better watch how you talk," the security guard interjected. "You are going to be hearing from me," she yelled. She should have called 911 earlier before playing fucking doctor on the street. A summer of stress for Phoenix's homeless. Anna did make it to the hospital and received care, but the confrontation over her emergency did not end well. The guards, who work for Lionheart Security, pushed Alicia and her partner Jessica Spencer onto nearby umbrellas that were providing shade to a homeless man, breaking them. The dispute, captured on video by the advocates, epitomizes the chaos of trying to serve homeless people on Phoenix's streets. As service providers and advocates work to help people through the potentially fatal heat, in a summer when the city has decided to curtail how and where people can offer help to the homeless, the conflict is inevitably rising with lives on the line. Maricopa County this year counted nearly 10,000 homeless people living in the county. Spencer and Alicia are advocates who provide aid to people living on the street in the zone. Alicia also runs the Instagram account at UnshelteredPHX and regularly films interactions between homeless people and police. She has to be identified only by her first and middle names out of fear of retaliation. The couple said that the August 1st incident captured the callous approach to homeless people who remain on the streets by the city and some employees of the contractors working with the homeless service providers in the area. The EMT and security guards should have called 911 immediately, Alicia and Spencer said, or at the very least asked Anna if she wanted them to. Instead, the EMT tried to cool Anna down herself without a working thermometer, while she sat on a blanket that a heat gun used by the advocates registered at 140 degrees. Meanwhile, security guards hovered, trying to intimidate them, Spencer and Alicia said, and brushed off the suggestion of calling 911. If she denies it, then ultimately we just wasted 911 calls, one of the security guards can be heard saying to the pair in the video. Later, a security guard said it wasn't the EMT's job to call. In the end, Spencer called 911. By the time the firefighters arrived, she and Alicia, who'd stumbled across the security guards and EMT helping Anna while out providing aid, had been on the scene for about 15 minutes. I still regret, like, feeling like they had any type of authority because there were so many hesitations that I did, Alicia said. If they were behaving like this while we were around them, then how were they behaving with every other call? I swear she was practicing her vitals. That's fucked up. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for other interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.